This is The State of Things. I'm Melinda Penn-Cava. Author Carol Boston Weatherford wasn't even school age in 1960 when four African-American students sat down at a lunch counter in Greensboro and asked to be served. She does remember growing up with segregation, though, and watching the civil rights movement unfold. Carol Boston Weatherford lives in High Point now. She has written a number of books about American history and African-American culture. Her newest is a children's book about the Greensboro sit-ins of 1960. It is called Freedom on the Menu, and author Carol Boston Weatherford joins us now. Welcome to The State of Things.
Glad to be here, Melinda.
Well, on this King holiday, we're nearing the 45th anniversary of those sit-ins, because that's coming up on February 1st. And so I guess the big overriding question for us is, how do you keep those stories about the civil rights movement alive for people who are coming of age two generations later?
Right. Memories of the Jim Crow era are fading and have been fading ever since passage of the Civil Rights Act. So my book is an attempt to introduce the student sit-in movement to young people who are too young to remember. Obviously, they weren't born when the movement took place. And in large part, some of the people who were involved are dying and are not alive to pass on those stories any longer. So that I write books about forgotten struggles, and this could become one if we don't keep talking about it.
Right. So how did you come to do this as a children's book? Did a light go off at some point?
Yeah, a light did go off. I, as you said, I live in High Point, and I had written several children's books. I've got more than a dozen children's books. And I wrote for the Greensboro News and Record for a while, and it just dawned on me, this story is right under your nose. There were articles in the newspaper about the sit-in museum, which is going to open in July in Greensboro, and I felt like it was my story to write, so I wrote it.
Indeed. Well, it is a story of triumph. Which is often good to have for a children's book.
It is. It is a story of triumph, and also young people started the movement. College students, of course, were the first to sit in at the lunch counter. But during the summer, when the college students went home, high school students participated in the sit-ins. So young people were central to this movement, and the sit-in movement actually marked a shift in the strategy of the civil rights movement to a more confrontational strategy. So I thought young people would be able to relate to the fact that young people were involved in the struggle.
Right. And you're telling this in Freedom on the Menu through the eyes of an 8-year-old girl.
Right. An 8-year-old girl who did not actually participate in the movement because she was too young. And she experiences it vicariously through her brother and sister, whom I have made students at Bennett College for Women and A&T. It was called A&T College at the time. So she's able to experience it through them, but also she has experienced the pain of the sting of segregation, because she's not able to sit at the lunch counter downtown and have a banana split the way her white counterparts are able to do. So,
well, I was wondering if you might read us a few of the opening pages of Freedom on the Menu, because I think it gets to that point of pointing out those things of everyday life.
Just about every week, Mama and I went shopping downtown. I loved having her all to myself for the afternoon. Whenever it was hot or we got tired, we'd head over to the snack bar in the Five and Dime store. We'd stand as we sipped our Cokes, because we weren't allowed to sit at the lunch counter. Once I watched a girl swivel a stool as she spooned a banana split. In the empty seat beside her was a purse almost exactly like mine. "Can I have a banana split?" I begged Mama. "Not here, Connie," said Mama. "I'll fix one at home." "Won't be the same," I grumbled. All over town, signs told Mama and me where we could and couldn't go. Signs on water fountains, swimming pools, movie theaters, even bathrooms. Everybody I knew obeyed the signs, except my great-aunt Gertie from New York. Once when she visited us, she drank from a whites-only fountain and said real loud, "I've never heard of colored water. Have you, Connie?" Then she lifted me up so I could take a sip. I looked up from the fountain. "Y'all know better than that," a man in a straw hat scolded. I started to say, "Sorry, mister," but Aunt Gertie just huffed. "I'm too old for silly rules." It was a real hot day, but the man walked away without taking a drink. There weren't any signs up in the Five and Dime, but we still knew how it was. Most people I knew didn't expect change any time soon, but my daddy thought different. "Dr. King's coming to town," he told us one morning. "Who's sick?" I asked. "He's not that kind of doctor, Connie," Daddy laughed. "He's a minister who's working to make things better for us," said Daddy. "So we can go anywhere we please," said Mama. "Like the lunch counter?" I asked. "Yep," said Daddy, "and other places, too."
Carol Boston Weatherford reading from her children's book, Freedom on the Menu. It's about the Greensboro sit-ins. On this Martin Luther King holiday, we're looking at how you keep stories about the civil rights movement alive. How do you lay out for children two generations later what it was like in the South half a century ago? We welcome your calls this hour. Our number is 1-877-962-9862. So, Carol, when all this was happening, you were what? You were not even in school yet in 1960.
Right, I was 4 years old in 1960. And I lived in Baltimore also, so I didn't grow up in North Carolina or the Deep South where the movement was taking place. But I did experience segregation, not much because my parents sheltered me from it. They didn't take me places that, you know, I wasn't allowed to go. They knew where black people could and couldn't go in Baltimore, so they didn't take me to the beach, to the segregated beach. There was a beach that we could go to, and we went to that one. Mm-hmm. I never knew an amusement park existed in Baltimore until after it had desegregated. So, you know, it never came up in the conversation.
So your parents were shielding you from the idea that these things were even out there, that they existed.
Exactly,
they didn't want to say no.
As many parents did, but it was more difficult to shield children in the South because there was more. The segregation was more pervasive. You know, there you couldn't sit at the lunch counter. There was a lunch counter in Baltimore that desegregated before I was born, so I could sit there and did sit there with my mother, but. You know, deeper south, that was not, farther south, that was not possible to shield children.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's an intriguing way of telling the story here, because I think those of us of a certain generation certainly know the Greensboro sit-in story, but to tell it through a child's eyes about the illogic of the segregation.
Yeah, and that's one thing that when I go to schools, that children are able to sense how inane segregation was. They ask me questions like, why were things that way? And I've even had biracial students ask, where would they have gone during that era? And that's, you know, that's a real, real deep question.
And what do you tell them?
Well, I say you would have gone with the people of color. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the fact of the matter is that during the segregation era, there were laws against, you know, against interracial sex. So they might not have existed during that time.
Right. It's got to be a tough row to hoe sometimes of doing a children's book and having a point of view but not being preachy about it.
Yeah,
and yours is not.
Well, thank you.
But how do you guard against that?
Well, one thing you want to make the child's voice authentic. So, you know, everything needs to be from the perspective of the child, and the child needs to actually experience the experience rather than just be a witness to it. And it is difficult. It is difficult. This went through many rewrites with my editor, so it would not seem like a history lesson. Mm-hmm. And it would be, you know, there would be more of a story, a family story. The book shows how her entire family was involved in the sit-ins and involved in history unfolding.
Right. Getting back to your own family, though, was it spoken about, the civil rights movement?
The civil rights movement.
You said your family shielded you from not being able to do those things that you wouldn't have been able to do.
Well, the civil rights movement was on television, so it didn't need to be spoken about because it was, you know, it was on television. Any night that there was, you know, there was a problem with demonstrations, that, you know, the fire hoses and the police dogs and the demonstrators were on television. So I saw that on television. Also, because I lived in Baltimore, which was right next to Washington, we were spellbound by the March on Washington. We didn't participate, but, you know, that was televised. There were conversations in my house about the Jim Crow era, because my grandfather had been an activist preacher in Tennessee. And my mother, you know, had seen his involvement with things like the Scottsboro Boys case. He was involved with Thurgood Marshall. When Thurgood Marshall, you know, would come through town, he'd stay at the house sometimes. So that was talked about, as was the incident that I mentioned about Aunt Gertie at the water fountain. Yeah. I have a real Aunt Gertie.
Did she do that?
She did that. She didn't. I don't know if she lifted up a child, but she went shopping with her sister when she visited Tennessee from Michigan, And her sister said, you know, you can't drink from that fountain. And she said, you know, who ever heard of colored water? And she drank from the white water fountain.
Was anybody there to witness it?
I don't know. I don't think anything happened as a result. But my grandmother was upset about it because, you know, she believed in, you know, obeying the law. Mm-hmm. And, you know, her sister who was visiting from up north was breaking the law.
Right. Right. So you're drawn to doing children's books about a number of these issues in American history that have to do with African Americans getting civil rights.
I am. I'm also drawn. My mission as an author is to mine the past for family stories, fading traditions, and forgotten struggles. So, you know, I've written a book about jazz because, you know, some people say jazz is dying, or at least among young
sure.
You know, I hope not, but you know, young people don't listen to jazz. Many young people don't. So I've written a book about jazz for children. I've got a book forthcoming about the Negro League, which existed because of Jim Crow.
Before Jackie Robinson.
Right, before Jackie Robinson. So, yes, I am drawn to those kind of stories.
Right. Well, we are talking this hour with Carol Boston Weatherford about her new book, which is called Freedom on the Menu. It's the Greensboro Sit-Ins. It's a story of that through a child's perspective. We'd be curious to hear your views. Our number's 1-877-962-9862. How do you keep the past, the civil rights movement, alive? We'll get back to more of our conversation in just a moment with Carol Boston Weatherford. All that ahead on The State of Things. Support for The State of Things comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners who support WUNC. This is The State of Things. I'm Melinda Penn-Cava. We are talking today with High Point writer Carol Boston Weatherford about telling stories of the civil rights movement to children. She has written a number of children's books about African-American history and culture. The latest is about the Greensboro Sit-Ins, which will be having their 45th anniversary come February 1st. The name of the book is Freedom on the Menu, the Greensboro Sit-Ins. And we've been talking about keeping that past alive. And for it's at least two generations now.
It's a challenge.
Yeah. What's the hardest part about keeping that alive? What's the biggest part of that challenge?
That's a tough question. I guess the hardest part of it is that children rely so much on electronic media for their information, and it's covered in the electronic media for 1 month of the year. You know, it's covered for the King Holiday. We'll see things on television today and hear things on the radio today. And during Black History Month, and then the rest of the year, you know, we won't hear about these things. So that's, you know, the challenge is to keep the conversation going all year long.
Right. Well, your book, in a short amount of time, it takes us through the sit-ins, through the eyes of this 8-year-old girl, Connie, who lives in Greensboro. Her older brother and sister are involved with the sit-ins because they're college students. And usually we don't like to, authors don't like to read the end of the book, but we know how the story ends. But
right,
we'd, I'd
right,
like,
we do.
If you could just tell us how it ends through Connie's eyes, the last couple of pages.
Now, instead of shopping downtown, we had to order from the Sears catalog. Mama and I leafed through the big, thick catalog together, and she even let me help pick out things. But we both knew it wasn't the same. How long before the sit-ins are over, Mama? I asked. Till folks get what they want, said Mama. That summer, Mama, Daddy, and I finally went downtown. When we passed Woolworth's, I heard someone shout, "They're serving them!" Daddy stopped so fast that the brakes screeched, and Mama and I jolted forward. We parked and ran to the lunch counter. There sat the women who worked in the restaurant's kitchen. They were all dressed up fancy and eating egg salad. I can't even stand the smell of egg salad, but I stood and watched them eat every bite. Looks pretty good, I said. Daddy and I shared big smiles. The next day, brother, sister, and I made a special trip downtown. Brother wore a suit and tie. We girls wore hats and white gloves. At Woolworth's lunch counter, I climbed up on a stool right between them. We'll have 3 hot dogs, 3 french fries, 2 coffees, 1 Coke, and 1 banana split, please, I told the blonde-haired waitress. Sister and brother sipped coffee, and I twisted on my stool while we waited for our meals. Our food soon arrived. As I ate, the waitress plopped an extra cherry on a mound of whipped cream. She still looked nervous, but she smiled at me. It was the best banana split I ever had.
Carol Boston Weatherford reading the concluding pages of her book, Freedom on the Menu. You write about these issues, parts of American history that have to do with the civil rights movement and gaining rights for African Americans and others. What are you working on now?
I'm working on a story about John Coltrane's childhood, a story about, I write historical fiction often, mm-hmm. A story about Wendell Scott, who was the first African-American driver to win a NASCAR race.
And these are all children's books?
These are all children's books. And then I've got some books forthcoming that are not, you know, they're not works in progress anymore. They're coming out in the next year or 2 years. I've got a Negro League scrapbook that's coming out in March. The Carolina Parakeet, which is a departure for me, it's a natural history for adults, is coming out sometime later this year. A book about Harriet Tubman, a book about Jesse Owens for children, and a book about the Cannon Street YMC All-Stars, a Little League team during the Jim Crow era.
That's busy.
Yeah. I write a lot. My job at Fayetteville State allows me ample time to write, and I'm happy about that.
Did you set out wanting to write children's books?
I set out writing poetry. I have an MFA in creative writing with a concentration in poetry from UNC Greensboro, and was writing poetry, have been writing poetry ever since I was in first grade, and began writing children's books after becoming a mother. So by the time I finished my graduate program at UNCG, I had my first children's book contract. So it kind of found me. Because I was reading books to my children, I found that there were many more multicultural books available now than there were when I was a child growing up during the Civil Rights Movement. And I thought, well, you know, another a light bulb went off, like you said earlier. Mm-hmm. I thought, well, maybe I can do this. And I've proven that I can.
Indeed. I wonder about this issue about passing down these stories, passing along these stories. There are books such as yours now that would be there for children to see, either the bookstore or the library. Are their parents just not passing down that?
Well,
those
some
stories
of the
among
parents...
among African Americans and whites as well. It's everybody's history, but among African American parents in particular, is there that passing down of this is how it was 45
well,
years ago?
I think that I don't want to say that the oral tradition is dying, mm-hmm. but because of electronic media, it's just not as strong among Americans in general as it once was. You know, we don't have to talk as much. And in many families, we don't talk as much. Also, generations of families are scattered. So, you know, you may have grandparents in one state and children and grandchildren in another state. So, you know, you're just not close enough. You don't have the proximity for oral traditions to take place, for the stories to get passed down.
Okay. Well, Carol Boston Weatherford, before you go, you have a poem for us as well. This is a poem for adults and children, right?
It's from Remember the Bridge, Poems of a People, which is actually a children's book, but the publisher says it's for all ages, so I guess that means adults can enjoy it, too.
And the setup for this is a King, and especially for King Day.
Right. The poem is inspired by King's letter from a Birmingham jail, in which he writes about why African-Americans could not wait for they were going to continue to protest and wouldn't just sit around and wait for change to come. So it shares some of his concerns as a parent, this particular part that's inspired by the letter. Martin's letter. Though sermons rolled off his tongue, Martin could not find words to tell his little brown girl why Funtown's gates were closed to her, or that the colored-only sign on the drinking fountain didn't mean the water was a different hue. But in a jail cell in Birmingham, he found words to tell the holy men why he would not halt the marches. He would rather fight off police dogs and face fire hoses than wipe his daughter's tears.
Well, Carol Boston Weatherford, thank you for being with us today.
Thank you, Melinda.
Carol Boston Weatherford is a writer living in High Point. Her new children's book is called Freedom on the Menu, The Greensboro Sit-Ins. She is also a professor at Fayetteville State University. Now, a section of the Woolworth lunch counter is part of the Smithsonian's American History Museum in Washington. Meanwhile, that old Woolworth building in Greensboro is in the process of becoming the International Civil Rights Center and Museum. It's to officially open, according to the executive director, Amelia Parker, on July 25th. 5th of this year, that would be the 45th anniversary of the day that African Americans were first served at that counter. About 3.5 years after the Greensboro sit-in, Martin Luther King delivered his famous I Have a Dream speech on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial. In 1963 is when that happened, and here now is a portion of that speech.
Let freedom ring from Stone Mountain of Georgia. Let freedom ring from Lookout Mountain of Tennessee. Let freedom ring from every hill and molehill of Mississippi. From every mountainside, let freedom ring in Windy Capital. When we let it ring from every village and every hamlet, from every state and every city, we will be able to speed up that day when all of God's children, black men and white men, Jews and Gentiles, Protestants and Catholics, will be able to join hands and sing in the words of the old Negro spiritual, free at last, free at last. Thank God Almighty, we are free at last.
This is The State of Things. I'm Melinda Pencava. In the mid-1980s, writer James Hall experienced a kind of conversion to the popular novel. As an English professor, he had considered himself above the likes of John Grisham and Margaret Mitchell until he says he actually read their books. Since then, James Hall has been studying bestsellers with all the seriousness of a scholar, and he has written more than a dozen thrillers of his own. Now, while sales of his own books have yet to rival John Grisham's, James Hall has built up a loyal base of readers in his home state of Florida. His latest novel is called Forests of the Night, and it's the first time James Hall has written a book that takes place outside of Florida. In it, a Florida policewoman unravels a mystery that involves her husband's family, an old Cherokee myth, and a summer camp in the mountains of North Carolina. Professor and writer James Hall is here with us. Welcome to The State of Things.
Thanks. Great to be here, Melinda.
Well, you have made a career out of setting books in Florida, and this time you venture out of the state and into the mountains of North Carolina.
Well, that's true. I was a little concerned that some of my Florida fans wouldn't come follow me along for the journey, but since so many Floridians do spend their summers in North Carolina, it wasn't too risky to do that.
Yeah. So the plot of this novel, it is built around a summer camp in North Carolina. And I understand this is very much like a camp you attended as a kid.
That's true. In fact, my dad went there as well. This was a family tradition. It's been around since the 30s. I went there as a camper since the age of 10. And when I got too old to be a camper anymore, I started to work there. Just couldn't imagine my summers without going to this Camp Sequoia, it was called, in near Asheville, Weaverville, North Carolina.
What was it like? What stood out in your memory about it?
Well, it was extremely rustic. It was sort of like an outward bound school long before there were outward bound schools. Those very difficult, challenging, wilderness, primitive kinds of situations where you learn about woodcraft and you test your strength against the natural environment. It was quite a shock for a middle class kid from Kentucky who had all the privileges of a normal middle class childhood, mm-hmm. to be thrown into the cold waters and harsh, unprotected environment of the outdoors.
Yeah, and here it turns up in this novel, the first that you've set outside of Florida, Forests of the Night. Let's talk a little bit about the novel. In it, we have a police detective from Miami, Charlotte, who has very keen intuition, and she and her husband end up in Cherokee, North Carolina.
Right. They discover that the husband, Parker, from a summer romance when he was only 15 or 16 years old back at summer camp, has a child he didn't know he had. And lo and behold, this child as an adult shows up in their life, and the wife recognizes this young man almost immediately as someone from the FBI most wanted list, and bang, we're off to the races.
Right. And the point is that we have this person who's on the FBI most wanted list, and that's Jacob, who is the attorney's son.
Right.
Son. And it goes back beyond the 30 years earlier when Jacob was conceived. This story goes
way back.
Way back too.
To 1838. It starts out at a point in Cherokee history that was is memorialized in the drama that takes place in Unto These Hills, this outdoor amphitheater over near Asheville every summer, which describes the Cherokee history and the Trail of Tears, the moving the Cherokees out of their land and marching them to Oklahoma. And in this particular story, just an ordinary Cherokee Indian named Sally, T-S-A-L-I, was captured and was marched away and broke away from his captors. And in the process of freeing his family from these captors, a couple of soldiers were killed. And Sally and his family fled to the mountains and hid up in the hills in North Carolina because they knew they were in deep trouble. And the American soldiers couldn't sit still for this because the insurgency might spread. I saw some parallels to our current situation in Iraq. And so they offered Sally a deal. If he would come down and give himself up to the firing squad, his people, the remaining Cherokees, would be allowed to stay in North Carolina. He did this, and that act of altruism starts out the novel, and it sort of was my guiding moral moment that helped keep me on track through the story.
And this is the story that has been passed down through generations for 170 years or so. There are some who have other... There are variations on the story as to whether... Exactly. Did he voluntarily offer himself, or?
That's correct. Yeah. Historians don't like to let things lie, you know. And there's quite a bit of debate and some doubt about the heroism of Sally's actions and whether it was in fact true. But I would like to believe that it's true. And if not Sally, then certainly there are other altruists that you could blend into the story. So I choose to believe it's true.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, I was wondering if you might give us a reading from the book, since so much of it happens in Cherokee, North Carolina, and it centers on the camp where we have the attorney from Florida, where he grew up, because his dad ran the camp.
That's correct,
right?
Yeah.
Until it burned 30 years earlier to the right. ground, and his father was killed. If you just might give us a short reading from there.
Okay, this is about the camp, then. This is, at Camp Sally, a large portion of every summer day was spent in diligent imitation of primitive Cherokee life. The boys bathed in the icy lake, prepared and cooked much of their own food. They felled giant poplars and locusts and maples, then worked the wood, turning the larger portions into logs to be used in building projects, and the smaller pieces into bows and arrows, blowguns, and hatchet handles. For 2 months, those suburban boys prowled the forest like young warriors, their ears tuned to the slightest vibrations of animal life, slipping through the pathless woods as surreptitiously as moonlight. They killed and skinned squirrels and other small game, and from the pelts they fashioned loincloths, vests, moccasins, and fur caps. From yellow pine they carved dugout canoes and tested them on the lakes and whitewater rivers. They whittled dance masks from buckeye and basswood, once a week performed in the big ceremonial ring the green corn dance or the eagle dance, chanting in Cherokee and whirling around blazing bonfires. It was on a lightless evening at the end of August, only moments after Corky Bondurant began to snuffle and snore, that Parker Monroe ducked beneath the blankets and shone his flashlight on the slip of paper he had discovered moments earlier beneath his pillow. "Meet me," it said in her careful script.
James W. Hall reading from his latest novel, Forests of the Night, which takes place in western North Carolina in Cherokee. In this book, we have Parker's father who runs the camp, who is Anglo. He is of Scots-Irish extraction.
Right.
But very much tries to imbue the idea of the Cherokee. Was, in fact, what he was doing, was that, in fact, say, Cherokee tradition? Or was it this nice idealized version of how the Cherokee may have lived in earlier times?
Well, that's a good... I hadn't really even considered that, but I think you're probably right that there is no way that he could have given us the true taste of Cherokee life. But he did a darn good job for 1950s in that unenlightened, politically incorrect age, to have even introduced kids like us, the sons of lawyers and realtors and doctors, and to a culture that we would never have otherwise gotten to know or honored in any way. And it was quite a changing life experience for, I think, all of the kids that went to that summer camp.
Did you have much contact with the actual Cherokee culture when you were at that camp, or was it mostly through the eyes of those who ran the kids' camp?
They had a couple of people on the staff who would come in and teach, who were Cherokees, full-blood Cherokees, who would teach Indian lore and teach the dances themselves, which we performed, as I described. So we a little contact, but it was very regulated and very guarded, and I'm sure very sanitized.
And how about when you went back to write the book? Did you go to Cherokee and do research there? And
yes.
I wonder what you found out about past interpretations.
Well, we tend to romanticize so much about our youth and sentimentalize things. And what I found was much different, of course. And Cherokee has changed dramatically. That whole region has changed dramatically, partly because of the casino and partly because of just the modern age has changed it.
Mm-hmm. We'll talk more in a moment with James W. Hall about his new book, Forests of the Night. If you have a question, our number here is 1-877-962-9862. That's 1-877-962-9862. More with James Hall on The State of Things. This is The State of Things. I'm Melinda Penkava, and we are talking with writer James Hall. Over the last 35 years, he's been writing thrillers and mysteries, a lot of them taking place in Florida. His latest novel is a departure. Forests of the Night takes place in and around a fictional version of the summer camp that James Hall attended as a child when he was in North Carolina. James Hall is with us in the studio. We're talking about the new novel and also what it takes to make a book a bestseller. Our number is 1-877-962-9862. So we were talking before the break about the Cherokee and the Cherokee Indians out in western North Carolina, and you having been to summer camp, and then as an adult researching this novel. One aspect of it that you hit upon, at least briefly here, is about there are people who specialize in verifying lineage, the genealogy of people who are Cherokee.
Yeah, that's true. I was struck by that. The way I work on books is I spend about a month at the beginning before I actually start to write doing research. And the best research is the kind of research where you go places and see the actual people and the natural environment that you're going to write about. And so I went to Cherokee. I live part of the year in Boone, so it was just a short trip for me to go down to Cherokee and hung around. And one of the things that was most compelling was to watch the Cherokee cable TV channel in which they broadcast the local government meetings. And it's very contentious. And one of the issues that came up was about this genealogical issue of verifying membership in the tribe, which becomes important because tribal members get a share of the pot of the casino that's there. And it's a form of, I guess, a blend of capitalism and welfare. But it's a little tawdry, the whole perversion of this culture that I'd always dignified and thought was so noble seemed a little crass on that edge. When I was observing this. And I tried to work one little scene into the novel that referred to this aspect.
Because you have somebody at a university who's in the business of basically verifying.
Yeah, it's
for a fee.
Yeah, they're picking up a little money on the side, university professor. I understand how that would work, yes.
Right. Well, you have been a university professor for years, and you've developed somewhat of a sideline, although I understand it's maybe coming out in book form soon, of studying and teaching about what makes a bestseller. So what's the secret?
Let me tell you first how I got started in this, because I think that's an indicator of what this whole subject is about for me. I was going to teach a course. It just popped into my head that it would be interesting mm-hmm. to sit around for a semester with some bright college students and talk about and make fun of bestsellers. This was my elite intellectual snob period that existed for many decades as I was going through graduate
school. How recently
was
this?
This was about, I'm well over it now, okay. Believe me. 1985, I think I taught this class the first time. But I was going to read Gone with the Wind and From Here to Eternity and The Exorcist, The Godfather, some of the biggest books of all time, and essentially make fun of these books and show how they were inferior to the literary canon, the books that were the approved, dignified literary novels that I was teaching 99% of the time and that my colleagues taught and approved of. And in my arrogance, I'd never actually read Gone with the Wind before. I'd always disdained it. So it came as an overwhelming shock to find that I loved this book. Sure, it was full of all these things that I had anticipated, which are technical problems like melodrama and superficial characters and one-dimensional characters as well, cliches.
Especially among the African Americans in the book.
Oh, yeah. Yes, very much so. But even the debutantes, the Southern mm-hmm. Belles. But nevertheless, the book transcended all that, and I was very moved and very swept up in it, and I had to go into the class and confess to them that I'd had this terrible experience, and they all were relieved because they loved it too, and they dreaded admitting that to me, this haughty professor. So then we had to determine what is it we're going to do instead of making fun of these books. And one of the things we did in that class, and I've done in subsequent classes, is to see if there are any common denominators between the biggest books of all time in terms of popular sales in America. And yes, in fact, lo and behold, I've detected at least a dozen that are very, very consistent, that run through very dissimilar kinds of bestsellers.
Are some of them very obvious?
Some of them, they are as soon as you say them. They become obvious, but they have implications that beyond just the one line of what the item is, the larger consideration is why these 12 things. What does this tell us about American culture? What are the many permutations of these 12 things? Because obviously, Peyton Place and Valley of the Dolls, on the face of it, would have very little in common with To Kill a Mockingbird or Gone with the Wind. Those books just don't seem to belong in the same universe, and yet they are the biggest bestsellers of all times, and they do share these dozen or so very similar conditions.
So give me some examples of some of these dozen keys to the bestseller.
Okay.
Traits.
I'll slip a couple of them to you, but I want to sit on the rest. One was the came totally unexpected. It was something we call the Golden Country. And that's a phrase that came from one of the books we were doing that very first class, 1984, George Orwell's novel about a futuristic society that's very sterile and bland and antiseptic. He would have this fantasy of a golden country, he called it, a beautiful field and a young woman running across this field, a very Edenic natural setting. And as that class unfolded, we found recurring golden countries in all of these books, that in each one of them, in very different ways, there was some very, very important but crucial, very small sometimes, but crucial description of a natural environment that was the sort of middle sea that from which everything else was measured in the book. Mm-hmm. I could give you some examples if you'd like.
Yeah, I'd love to hear an example. Are you talking here about a sense of place? Or is that
be a sense of place. It can be a sense of time, or both of those things together. In Gone with the Wind, for instance, it's obvious, it's self-evident. It's Terra before the fall. It's for Scarlet. It's that perfect natural environment and the social natural environment. And yet, when you start to look at the passages that describe this, the beautiful afternoons and the weather and in any kind of natural settings, it's all shot through with slavery. Slavery is omnipresent, even in those moments of natural description, which is a very telling feature, that the original sin was there even in the Garden of Eden. Mm-hmm. In a book like The Firm, for instance, John Grisham's bestseller that rivals these others in sales, it's only a line or two in which Mitch McDeer and Abby, who have at this stage of the book become totally wrapped up in this materialistic life of a successful young lawyer in Memphis. And their lives are sort of wrecking all around them because of their materialistic needs. And what their golden country is, they have a memory of how simple and wonderful it was back in law school when they lived in a one-bedroom apartment and ate pizza. And there it is, bingo. It's a time, not a place, but without that moment, you wouldn't know how deeply they descended into this darkness of materialism. It acts in the same function as...
It's almost like a ruler or a gauge.
Exactly. It's a measuring point.
So you're saving a lot of these. You're holding your fire on telling us a lot of these because you're saving these for a book that you hope to be a bestseller?
Well, I was contacted in a very roundabout way by a woman who's at Random House, and they wanted me to do this book, and I did a proposal, and they snapped it up and said this is very exciting to them. I think they secretly want to know, to help them choose their books better, why Da Vinci Code comes out of nowhere and becomes this enormous book. What is it about this book? I don't know that I can tell them exactly, but I can give them... These 12 are actually it's more than 12, but I it's a kind of a baker's dozen, but I can give them some of these guidelines. I think that's their curiosity about it.
How important is dialogue in that list? I mean, and a dialogue that stands out and snaps off the page. Is that?
It's not on my list. It's in fact almost anything having to do with style and language, the use of language, either very effective, highly poetic, or very simple on one end or the other, is almost irrelevant. There's quite an enormous range of style and lack of style in bestsellers, the biggest books of all time. There is a lot of dialogue in some of the bestsellers, but in others, it's an enormous amount of exposition. Gone with the Wind, there's very little conversation. It's surprising. We tend to recollect the movie version of Gone with the Wind, and it's dialogue driven. But the book itself is filled with long passages of exposition and description, not dialogue at all.
And do you think that reading audiences haven't changed over the 70 years since it first, say, Gone with the Wind first came out? Might people be expecting more dialogue now? Or
well, I think they expect a different pace. I think that's true. Yes, absolutely. However, these 12 things still exist. The Da Vinci Code has them in spades, just as a book that's 60 years old has them as well. It's quite amazing, and one of the things I try to do in the book is talk in a lighthearted way. This is not a scholarly book, because it's more a book that sort of frees people up to say it's okay to read Bridges of Madison County. It's okay to read Daniel Steele and Clive Cussler and books that they feel somewhat embarrassed to carry around and to show, because there's such a high culture prejudice against a certain set of books. And on the other hand, I see it in my classes as a way to stimulate conversation. Why do we believe what we believe? Why do we create this hierarchy in literature and place some books at the top and other books in this sort of trash bin that the popular culture novels usually are in?
But you still reserve the right to say there are some bestsellers that are just not very good.
Well,
are you saying all bestsellers are good?
No, I don't really use the good word. You know, the way I escape that is I say my one-liner for this is that Jacqueline Suzanne is just as worthy of study as John Updike. Not as good necessarily, but by what standard? Good is a shaky term, or is an elusive term. Harold Bloom wouldn't say it's an elusive term. But when you start to analyze
it... Because he says there's a canon. There are books that are well-written, and there are those that are
not. Exactly.
Yeah. So for your writing, so this is about 20 years ago, you had this epiphany.
Exactly.
About best-selling. And so you then applied that to your own writing? Did you have a number of books that you'd written and weren't published?
Yes, I did. Prior to 1985, I'm not saying that that teaching this class was the one and only thing, but it certainly didn't hurt to have studied bestsellers and to see what it is, what the dynamics are in very, very successful stories. I had published, or I'd written four novels prior to this that will never see the light of day. Even if I were to go in and win the Nobel Prize, no one would ever publish these. They're that bad. They're horrible. But after I had taught this class and after I realized how difficult this task was of writing a novel and learned to rewrite a little better, I did, in fact, get my literary career started with the first novel in 86.
And you tend toward thrillers, toward mysteries.
Yeah, I've always loved these books. And the John D. MacDonald, Elmore Leonard, James Lee Burke, books that are sort of in that middle world there that are entertainments, but they can have a little nourishment as well.
Yeah. But a Miami Herald review of your latest book, Forests of the Night, says, blood ties, greed and revenge mesh with depravity, obsession, and in cinema verite on a time-tested narrative skeleton.
Well, so good that for him. He should be promoted to the New York Times.
That gets to what you're saying. There's this. Is it just a formula?
I wish it were. You know, if it were a formula, this whole thing would be a lot easier. Even knowing these 12 things and coming back to them in my mind, and it's not as easy as just recirculating these 12 things. There's some magic fairy dust that needs to be applied that is beyond just the flour, sugar, and water that goes into the recipe.
Right. Well, in addition to the thriller that propels this book along, the whodunit and why, there's also an issue that you raise, and that's schizophrenia. And that is that we have this this detective from Miami and her husband, who's the lawyer from Miami area, are in Cherokee because their 16-year-old daughter, who is schizophrenic, has fled there.
Right.
This is not a subject you took up before in your books.
No.
Is it?
It's touchy. It's a difficult thing to write about, and I took it on with great reservations. My publisher, when they read the novel the first time, urged me to make her a troubled teen instead of to tune it down, to dial it back, to make her into a cliche rather than a schizophrenic girl.
Well, it's tough to write about because, and I'm no pun intended here, but it's not just writing in one voice. It's writing in several here. And this is a girl who is just kind of taken by the movies and thinks Steven Spielberg is talking to her about this role she's going to get.
Right, yes. Well, it's roughly based on a friend of mine and his son who I've spent a great deal of time around. And this is one of the voices he hears is Steven Spielberg. So that was I've been doing unintentional research on this subject for years in observing this child. And it was tough, but that's one of the writer's jobs, I think, is to speak in voices other than his own or her own. That means gender voices, social class voices. And this was, I took a plunge when I was dealing with this young girl, but to me, it's the heart and soul of this book. Without her, I wouldn't have the same level of enthusiasm and interest in writing the book that I did.
Well, James Hall, thank you for talking with us today.
That was a thrill. Okay.
James Hall is a professor at Florida International University and the author most recently of the novel Forests of the Night. He'll be reading from his book tonight at 7 at Quail Ridge Books in Raleigh. That's the state of things for today. Thank you, as always, for listening. If you have a comment about the program, you can drop us an email here at sot@wunc.org. Support for the state of things comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. I'm Melinda Pencava.